Hey Rachel, can you hear me?
Yes.
Awesome. Sweet. Yeah, seems to be better without the headphones. All right, so today's guest is Rachel Stott, a naturopathic practitioner based in South Canterbury, New Zealand, with a special interest in multiple sclerosis. And so today's episode is going to be all about multiple sclerosis, Rachel's healing story, how she helps others. And I've got a few questions that I collected from listeners and the internet. So welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Cool. So I think if you could start off with just the basics of your experience, you know, with what a brief summary. I'm sure most listeners who are interested already know what MS is, but maybe a brief summary of what it is and how you found out you had it, or how it happened in the first place, and how you healed yourself.
MS is a relatively common autoimmune disease. What happens? The body decides that basically that I got it described to me. The inside of the electrical cord starts attacking the outside of the electrical cord, that being the nerves of the body. So it affects like the white matter of the nerves. That's a myelin sheath, and breaks that down. And for the sclerosis, it forms lesions. And I ended up with lesions on my brainstem that affects balance and walking. I've had a subsequent MRI to show that they've been healing, which is good news. I had a severe first MS attack in February 2013, and I was unable to see, unable to walk. I was in hospital for about 10 days on IV steroids. They actually made me really sick. And when I got home, I decided that I was just going to make myself walk because there was no way I was going to spend my life not walking. And it was down to the letterbox, and then it was one house down from me, then it was down to the park. It was just a little bit more every time, and most people now are unable to tell that I have MS.
So what's the like first thing that happens to people?
Well, actually, before the first MS attack, I was really, really fatigued. Like that went on for probably a year ahead of time. Floaters in my vision. Think sleep disturbances. I'd be up every night for long hours because I just couldn't sleep. I was getting hives all the time, like lots of things I ate. I'd get swollen legs or hives on my legs or wherever because food was really disagreeing with me. Bladder control issues. I just wasn't handling things very well, I didn't think. And then of course, when I had the first MS attack, I realized, well, okay, that's why this was so bad. And actually, a specialist, they said I didn't have MS at that time. I might not develop into MS, but then obviously 4 months later I had a mild MS attack, and it was another lesion on my brainstem. They said, well, you've got MS, but obviously I already gathered that before they diagnosed me. The signs are very obvious.
What is the official medical explanation for, and what's your opinion of the fact that this can just happen mid-life? That's one thing that surprises me a little bit, that you know, a person could be living fine for the first 30 years of their life and then have this start to affect them. What's the official explanation for that?
Well, I think from my research, it's pretty much that time of intense stress causes causes as the last trigger for the MS to develop. For me, I had a severe upper respiratory infection the week before I had that MS attack. So 5 days, I was so crock. I was lying on the couch, really blocked up and sick in summer, really hot summer, freezing cold. And the Saturday, I woke up, I felt perfectly fine, really tired, but perfectly fine. And the Sunday, I was a mess. Every time I moved, I spewed. I couldn't walk in a straight line. I couldn't see. And apparently, it's quite common for a virus to trigger it too.
Okay. And so I guess it's like something which is dormant, you know, and then like an epigenetic condition. You know how some people say that you have something, but then your environment changes or something in your life changes, and then that's what triggers the kind of activation of this something that was problematic prior, but it wasn't actually giving you symptoms. Do you think that makes sense?
Definitely makes sense. Like, I think it's explaining to people the difference between genetics, as in something like haemophilia that someone's born with, as compared to if I'd done things differently in my life, then I may not have MS right now.
And obviously, you know, you were interested in natural health and everything before this happened, weren't you?
Yes.
Yeah. So when did you go the mainstream route at all to see what mainstream medical practitioners would say and prescribe? Like, I presume, correct me if I'm wrong, that they prescribe some sort of pharmaceutical pill or something to manage this condition?
I was recommended taking the drug Copaxone, and I went to the pharmacist and got a printout and realised that I was contraindicated to take that drug. I've been offered it 6 or 12 times, I forget. Like, every time I've been near MS clinics, it's been recommended I take that drug. And I thought, well, I'm just going to look into how I can do it by myself. I actually viewed Dr. Terry Walls, her TEDx talk after the first MS attack, and her experience was quite compelling. She had been on a whole lot of drugs for MS, including chemotherapy, and she was in a reclining wheelchair because she was so sick. And she decided to investigate how to heal herself because she wanted to be alive to watch her children grow up. And she had a lot of dietary recommendations that made a lot of sense. And I thought, well, okay, I think that's more, that resonates more with me than the drugs. But consequently, I did have another MS attack, and then I was diagnosed. It takes 2 MS attacks generally to be diagnosed.
So Copaxone, to me, just intuitively doesn't sound good. Do some patients experience short-term benefits from that?
Well, actually, I've never met any person with MS who has taken Copaxone. There are a whole lot of different MS drugs, and they've got some people would say they've had a good result from taking the drugs. They're very, very strong drugs, pardon me, the MS modifying drugs.
So
often they're infusions, so an MS patient would need to see an MS nurse to get those infusions once a month. Some of them, after a while, they are able to produce them as an oral daily medication, like other medications, but they're very, very expensive. like typically tens of thousands of dollars a year for each person that takes those drugs. And a funding PharmAc, well, they get applications for funding, and I've had one MS patient, not my client, tell me that she's done so well on a drug, but she's been told she will never get funding again for it. And she's so worried about what happens when her funding runs out. And added to that, many of the MS drugs have, honest to goodness, terrible side effects. Like one drug, Galenia, if funding's removed or the MS patient chooses to stop taking the drug, they may get something called the rebound effect. So every MS attack that was held back while they were taking that drug comes all at once, once they come off the drug, and typically they would end up in hospital very sick.
Sounds very nasty. So you don't know anybody who, so most people that you've met, do they, who come to you for treating for this, do they, or for advice on this, have they gone the mainstream route and suffered the side effects of these other medicines, or are sometimes people just switched on to come straight away and go the natural?
I think honestly most people are quite afraid when they get an MS diagnosis. For me, it was very obvious what was going on with me, so it was a relief when they diagnosed me. But typically I don't see people when they first get diagnosed. Usually it's after a while when they think, what can they do for themselves, because they want to change things with their health. I have one client at the moment who has, she's not on any of the MS medications, but I have had clients who have been, and I just have to ensure that anything that I do with them, there are no contraindications to the medications. I'm unable to make recommendations or changes to medications without sending them back to their prescriber. I'm working in with the prescriber. So if a client wants to come off one of those drugs, they have to go back and talk to typically the MS specialist, because they're the experts on those drugs. I'm not an expert. I'm not trained in medications.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's that problem that we have for lots and lots of different health problems that, you know, it would probably be against the law or the rules of your governing body for you to say certain things. You know what I mean?
Yes, it's out of scope of practice for me to advise on drugs. So it's illegal, and I definitely would not do that. I can say to clients that I've looked up on the MedSafe data sheet online, and that states these side effects from that particular drug, whichever client it is, whichever diagnosis they have. And I've had clients say to me, well, I want to stop taking that drug, I'll just stop taking it. And I'm like, no, you have to go back to your prescriber, because if something happens, then you might end up in hospital or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's sort of, this is a bit of a tangent, but it's such a repetitive, boring story that we happens just for so many conditions where there's, you know, there's people like us that are concerned about the negative side effects of a particular medication, but you're sort of put in these positions where you are restricted in how and what you can say about it. I mean, I'm not claiming to be a medical practitioner, so I can sort of say whatever I want just as a lay person talking to myself. None of this is ever medical advice, by the way.
No, this is just general. Like, this is just a general talk about
what we're having a chat. Yeah. But you know, like in one of my experiences with medicine is that I was given drugs that had a side effect of suicidal ideation, and the doctors didn't even bother to mention that, you know, and the pharmacist didn't psychologist didn't. It's a recurring narrative, and it's not just with medicine. It's even with, you know, the chemicals involved in farming. You know, people saying we shouldn't be using this because it will have this risk, but they, you know, no one listens, or a new technology. I'm sure you're familiar with, you know, radio frequency radiation and whatnot. It's the same story every single time. Like normal people saying, "Hey, let's not do this," and then we just go ahead and do it anyway. But putting that to one side, what are some of the common myths of treating MS? Like we were talking before about how some people have said veganism, which doesn't resonate with you.
No, it doesn't resonate with me. Also, the low fat. I think the SWINK diet is what some people with MS take on board. That's very low fat and no saturated fat, no animal products. And the brain and the myelin sheath, they need fat. So if you're eating no saturated fat, how is the myelin sheath meant to heal? This is just my opinion for my own body. It's not telling people with MS go and load up on saturated fat when someone else has told you not to. You need to do your own research. But for me, I decided, no, I need to eat saturated fat. I need to have animal products. And it's made a lot of sense. It just, if you look at, like, the makeup of what's in animal products, I mean, we are animals, so it makes more sense to have them. And in saying that, plants are really of benefit too. Of course, our veggies, eat your veggies is just so important as well. But then with looking at various diets, there are some people who say not to eat nuts and seeds and grains and nightshades, for instance, because and beans, because beans and nightshades may cause an immune response in an already stressed immune system. And like some things are just really hard to break down too. And that stresses the body out and potentially may cause gut stress in some people. But then people need to find what resonates for them, what makes them feel good, work on themselves and work with a practitioner who offers individualized advice.
Yeah, the saturated fat's an interesting one because, I mean, to me, you don't even need to be looking at it from like an MS perspective. It's just all the information we've been told, or most of the information we've been told for decades that saturated fat is bad is like garbage science. Like I haven't looked into it deeply, but some of my friends have. The Ansel Keys was I think the researcher, and there were some problems with the way he conducted one of his studies.
Yes.
I hope I'm correct on that.
Yes.
And
he promoted sugar because he was paid by the Sugar Council.
Right. Okay. I didn't know that exact detail. Yeah. And it's just like you said, we're animals. It's common sense. If yes. you break away from the mainstream dogma that we would have a range of foods in our diet and the meat would be, red meat would be a decent portion of that.
Yes.
Due to its many benefits. Have you heard of people using the carnivore diet for MS?
I have, but I've never done it myself and I've never recommended it to a client. But then I'm open-minded because there are some people who, just by reports that I've read, it may be of great benefit for. But the problem with the carnivore diet is many of those who think that might be a good idea, they probably will be unlikely to eat raw organ meat to get enough vitamin C. And actually, a lot of people don't eat much organ meat and therefore miss out on many nutrients because of that.
Yeah, like you're involved with the Western A Price community down there, like I was.
Yes.
It's the carnivore diet, it's a fad, but the idea of increasing you know, the ratio of meat to other things in the diet is makes total sense. Yes. And yeah, like you said with the vitamin C thing, why not just be like carnivore with some fruit and some veggies that you tolerate well and some nuts that you tolerate well? There's no need to go 100%. Although, if you follow Sean Baker on Instagram, he's a doctor over in the US, there's been a lot of cases, I think, with carnivore diet, it's just the elimination factor, temporary elimination of something that was, you know, hindering someone's ability to kind of break through to a new level of health. And then once they remove whatever that is, whether it's a lectin or I forgot all the different anti-nutrient names, but removing those temporarily, going 100% carnivore can help with that. But yeah, people needed to kind of do their own research and make that decision.
They definitely do. And I find with most people with autoimmune that dairy and gluten maybe triggers. And I guess it makes sense because they're both inflammatory. And with gluten, I mean, considering celiac disease is a really probably the most common autoimmune disease, then that kind of makes sense with other autoimmune disease. Like once you have one, you're more likely to develop another.
I forget. This is a bit of a dumb question, but I didn't know that celiacs was an autoimmune disease. I thought it was just a gut health issue, you know, gluten intolerance.
I discovered it once I started researching, once I had the first MS attack, and I hadn't realised either. And it does seem very common with other autoimmune diseases that there's a link to gluten, celiac disease and definitely gluten intolerance.
With the gluten and the dairy, are you in agreement that it's the quality and like fermentation status and whatnot that makes a significant difference? Like those people who are not tolerating, you know, as MS or whether or celiac or whatever, not tolerating dairy, they would tolerate if it was, you know, organic or close to organic raw milk. And if it was the sourdough, fermented sourdough, they're going to tolerate that rather than the regular supermarket bought bread.
Not in many cases.
Oh, really?
No. Actually, one of my clients thought that she was fine with A2 milk, raw milk, and I just said, well, maybe just cut it out for a month and see how you go. And she discovered she was really sick if she had it. I think she's okay with butter, but and she's very intolerant to gluten too, and she actually thinks she's quite intolerant to grains in general. So it's, I mean, gut issues just seem to go hand in hand with autoimmune. Looking at it from a naturopathic perspective, I mean, your health is in your gut, and I would say so many health issues they stem from gut health and what people are eating.
Yeah. What would be the, obviously no recommendations, but what are the common supplements that people try for MS that in your opinion aren't so good, and which ones do people try and tend to have some success with? Because I'm thinking, so it's a nerve. Well, like nerves are part of the issue here, so you'd want something that helps with nerve health, possibly like blood flow, like, you know, ginkgo biloba. I don't know. I'm just brainstorming. What supplements help?
Well, with MS, typically they would be either on a prescription for vitamin D from their medical doctor, or they choose to take a supplement for vitamin D, and typically they would take it without vitamin K. So it seems to me that with some people that's potentially doing more harm than good. And I think for some people, obviously, they feel so much better when they take the vitamin D supplement. So it makes no difference for them personally whether it's got a cofactor. To explain, vitamin D needs a cofactor of vitamin K2 to be well absorbed, because or else it tends, the theory is that it may not be absorbed and it may cause additional health issues in some people without the K2. But I think, there are some issues with taking vitamin D, because sometimes, with a vitamin D blood test, it's often not subsidised by the district health boards. Some areas more likely to be, and with MS, I think maybe more likely to be than just a person with a different health condition. But it's good if you're taking a vitamin D supplement to get tests now and again, just to see what your levels are like. I've had toxicity once and I felt really unwell. So that's why I always recommend getting your levels tested before you supplement with it. I've also had an allergic reaction to 30,000, I think it was 30,000, it might have been 50,000 IU tablet of vitamin D that was prescribed by my specialist. So I've never taken that again.
Interesting. Yeah, I've never had my vitamin D levels measured. I'd really like to get that done. But on the topic of vitamin D supplements, a guy I chat with online sometimes, Matt Blackburn, he's also got a podcast. He's really, really anti vitamin D supplementation. Thinks it's generally harmful. But and you were sort of alluding to that, if people aren't taking K2 with it.
I think it's safer, in my opinion. I'm not a medical doctor, but so this is just my own opinion from an naturopathic perspective. From my learning, that it's better to take it with K2 because it's more easily absorbed. But then many of the supplements, they, like, if you walk into the health store, you look online, many of them are just vitamin D3 rather than plus K2. Some do have K2 with them. I think the problem is with MS too, like many of the drugs that are prescribed for MS, they have side effect of photosensitivity. The drug I was talking about, Galenia, my friend who's on that drug, she said she wishes she'd been told before she took it that about the rebound effect and about the increased risk of skin cancers. And she's very careful about keeping out of the sun. But then she's also eats vegan with fish and no fats. So I guess she's at more risk of a vitamin D deficiency than other people, because vitamin D is also in lots of butter, grass-fed meats would often have that in the fat. And so if she's not eating those things, and of course eggs, she's not eating those things, that will be more predisposing someone to a vitamin D deficiency. But she needs to keep out of the sun because she's had issues with basal cell serosomas since taking Galenia.
Would you say that, because like my thing would be get more sunlight, and if you can, if you're mobile, move somewhere closer to the, you know, slightly closer, you know, because New Zealand's, you know, is north-south kind of a setup, so you could move further north and get more sunlight. And then, like you said, eat more animal protein or animal products during the winter months to kind of top you up. But have you heard of the Spurti vitamin D lamp? It's like it's a few hundred dollars, but it's a lamp that's got tons of science behind it. Like it's only 10 minutes. face it at your body with, you know, most of your clothes off, and it increases vitamin D levels. Have you heard of that?
No, I haven't heard of that. I rely on the sun over summer to get my vitamin D levels up. But I think some people with MS, yes, they have moved to a warmer climate, like closer to the equator. And some used to use sunbeds. I don't know whether they do now. But see, this is the other thing that that you've just brought up. I mean, the greater prevalence of MS. I believe Southland, if someone grew up in Southland, they'll be more likely to develop MS than someone that grew up in Northland. Because, but the only country that bucks the trend with that is Japan, due to their diet.
You mean despite them being relatively far north?
Yes. But I think one of the highest incidences in the world is in Scandinavia.
And,
yes. And, so, and Scotland is very high. I think New Zealand's high. The north of North America's high. And yes, Japan bucks the trend when they're quite far from the equator.
Yeah, it's interesting. It'd be interesting to know what the within Japan data is, whether, you know, the northern parts versus the southern parts, whether that does or doesn't buck the trend internally. But
I've never seen any data breaking it down just on Japan in general.
Yeah. Okay, so generally more sunlight's a good thing.
Sunlight with moderation. But I think we're kind of in a position now that we spend a lot of time inside and all covered up when we go outside, sunscreen, and a lot of us get next to no UVB over summer because we're all covered up. And it's just, I think there's such a great fear of the sun. And really, how did humans evolve? We were outside in the warmer months in the sun, and we've kind of got to think about getting back to that.
Yeah, totally. It's that's kind of how I look at every single disease or infection or whatever it is. Then they all have different names, but there's thousands of general things that we can do to be more healthy that don't require you to know which exact condition you have. Everyone would benefit from seeing the sun or looking in the direction of the sun before they look at their phone first thing in the morning. You know, everyone would benefit from a little bit less time on their computer or phone before sleep. Everyone would benefit mostly from more animal products, decent quality animal products in their diet. Yeah, there is a big fear of the sun in New Zealand. Like, every time I try to bring it up with, well, not every time, but when I try to bring it up with people, especially people older than me, they have this huge fear complex around melanoma. I think because New Zealand supposedly has quite bad rates for that.
It does. And, I mean, those are things that are real concerns. But then equally, lack of sunlight, lack of vitamin D has been implicated in a lot of disease, like cancer, autoimmune. And I just, excuse me. I think sensible sun exposure as opposed to roasting ourselves all day, every day over summer, being moderation. In my opinion, as naturopathic opinion only.
Yeah, and I guess I can't remember what he would say, but Dr. Jack Cruz would probably have a good answer for why New Zealand has the melanoma rates, because he's sort of an expert on the sun and its benefits. But I would say for sure that people are probably doing it kind of like all in one, like having occasional days where they spend heaps of time in the sun instead of regular sun a moderate amount regularly to build up, like they call it a solar callus, I think. You know, so the body kind of gets more used to it and builds up a natural, nice tan. And also I'd say, I don't know, this is getting quite off topic from MS, but, you know, sunscreens are all pretty much all of the brands that contain toxic ingredients. Like some of them contain cancer causing chemicals. And so, you know, how do we know they're not part of the melanoma problem?
Yes, exactly. We don't know. I think many of the natural sunscreens though have been found to be lacking in what they claim to, the properties that they claim to have. So we need to be aware of that if we're choosing a natural sunscreen.
Mm-hmm. So we were supposed to be talking about supplements, and you mentioned vitamin D, possibly in combination with K. But are there any other ones that people tend to get good results with, or tend not to?
I think it's more people will say they're on all these things and they're poor quality, or like with B vitamins with autoimmune, often there will be an MTHFR gene mutation that has some researchers have found is connected to autoimmune, but some may not have it. Like it's apparently relatively common in the US.
Okay.
But that would mean poor methylation, and it affects absorption of B vitamins, and potentially might affect detox and hormones, the immune system, digestion, you know, like most processes in the body, I guess. But regular B vitamins probably less beneficial for some people, might be less beneficial for some people with MS. And I just think in general, some people with MS take poor quality supplements because they're recommended by someone who has got MS somewhere, I'll buy my supplements, and they're just supplements. You know, it's just something that someone wants to make money out of.
What are you on supplement wise?
A few, and that individual for me. So I prefer not to say what I take. I take some general minerals, some vitamins that I think benefit me, and I make myself some herbs, like from different what I think I need at that time.
Is there a debate amongst the MS community on whether or not it is 100% curable or not?
I would say from my research that there is no cure. There are some people go and have stem cell that is unappealing for me. They have stem cell treatment. I've got a friend who had that done, and she is obviously benefited here. There is such a thing as benign MS. I've not looked into that very, very thoroughly because I don't have it, so I didn't look into it particularly in depth. I went and got my amalgams removed by an holistic dentist and did the heavy metal protocol, and that made a big difference to me. But then some people with MS might be filled with horror with the idea of having it done, and might affect their mental health, so it might not be right for them. Everyone's different with MS. I'm guessing there is no one in the world with MS who is exactly the same. It's so diverse. Different backgrounds, different triggers, different methods of dealing with it. And I do honestly think that being in the right headspace really makes a difference for me. When I'm positive. I think my health is in better shape, and when I'm down at the dumps, my health seems to be in worse shape.
Yeah, that makes sense. One of the other people I've got lined up to interview is pretty into that, the healing mindset. But you, do you, because I really do think that for most things, like apart from, you know, an amputated foot or, you know, a few other things like that, I feel like anything is healable. It's just like 100% curable, but it's just, I mean, do you have the resources to buy all the things or have access to all the things required? Like, I feel like if we had true abundance on the planet and had, you know, we removed all the toxic things, we filtered all that out of the air, water, food, everything was organic, and you know, if we optimized everything, do you agree with me that in that case, you know, this would be curable 100%?
I honestly don't know. I don't know. Like, I think when I look at some people with MS, like, their bodies have degraded so much, deteriorated so much over the years, and so they've got muscle wastage because their bodies no longer allow them to move in the way that they used to move. And so, I mean, even with the best of food and lacking in, you know, like, contaminants and things, it's hard to know how people would heal, if they would heal. And, like, the mind-body thing, I don't know. Some people, they may be resistant to healing. I think one thing with MS that has bugged me over the years is some people are so negative. Like, they've got a really lovely family who loves them and cares for them very much. They've got a roof over their heads. They've got food they like eating that nourishes them. You know, like, their needs are being met, and the birds are singing, and life's going on, and they fail to see the good things in life. And that, I think, I try and appreciate the good things of life in life. I know that sometimes I fail to do that, but hopefully I do actually achieve that more often than I don't. And I think if I were negative, if I were really negative all the time, would my health be how it is now? I think I would probably be in a wheelchair if I had a really negative attitude. But that's me and my body, that I need to see the good things. I need to, like, go out and smell the roses. I need to give my dog a cuddle and take my dogs for a walk. You know, things like that, the nice things. Smile at people. Try and be positive, because, you know, life's for living and it's for seeing the best in.
Yeah, yeah. I think a lot of people will resonate with that. And it's sort of like the negativity that holds people back in healing is sort of like a psychological virus. But I kind of give them the benefit of the doubt.
I'll tell my husband I can't reach.
Pardon?
Yeah,
also, but sometimes, like, I know I'm
not having the best day or the best morning or whatever, and I'll tell my husband he needs to reach something high up for me rather than me, like, potentially having a bit of a wobbly on, like, standing on something. But I try to tell myself.
You've cut out there.
Oh, I'm still here. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now. What were you saying? Your husband having to grab something high for you?
Well, rather than me having a wobbly patch and when I know that I'm having a bad day, usually for me, it's just fatigue. If I get really stressed, sometimes I get tingly down one side of my body. Sometimes I get shaky legs, or if I'm really tired. But usually I'm pretty okay.
I feel like with the negative people, or the people who are having a negative phase in their kind of healing journey, it's, I don't want to, you know, disempower them by saying it's not their fault, because that makes it sound like they can't do anything about it. But I feel like there's a part of the brain, there can be cases where like there's literal brain damage that actually prevents people or hinders people's ability to maintain a positive outlook. Like that's one of the things I've looked into with some of the medication I was on as a child. Like it literally burns out the dopamine receptors, and so the regulation of like happy emotions is distorted and retarded. And so like, I'm not saying that's what's in the case for, because most people haven't been on these sort of meds, but you know, I it's really hard for some of those people, I guess, that those that you found that are negative, that there's something going on physiologically or psychologically that's holding them back from the optimal attitude.
Well, I'm not them, so it's difficult for me to comment, but I have actually known a woman with MS who was wheelchair bound, and she was actually in a rest home at quite a young age, and she's so lovely, always smiling, always joking, but she's struggling in every which way physically, but she's lovely to be around, lovely to talk to, and obviously takes great pleasure in life. And I like that attitude, and I try to be positive like that as much as I can.
Yeah, gratitude, they say gratitude, I think, is like the law of gain or increase. Like you have to be grateful for what you have as like a foundation for achieving or having more.
Yes.
So, okay, there are a few other things. Oh, genetics, I wrote down. So genetics, is there a genetic basis to MS in your personal opinion?
In my family, mum's cousin had that, but no one like really closely related to me had it. The research I've done, it looks like, well, it's females who are more likely to develop autoimmune disease, and I think there's approximately 3% greater risk of developing MS if your close family members had it. But I mean, I think there's a high incidence of developing an autoimmune disease if a close relative's had an autoimmune disease. But if like with me, with two daughters, and I have MS, I don't know. I mean, it might be celiac disease, it might be nothing. We don't know. They're healthy. My daughters are healthy now, so hopefully that continues.
Yeah. So it's sort of hard to know, basically.
Well, they don't have the health issues that I had at their ages. They're in their early 20s, and the fatigue that I had when I was in my early 20s, they thankfully don't have that. Fatigue, it doesn't affect everyone with MS or everyone with autoimmune, but neurological fatigue can be quite debilitating at times. And like for me, it was a hallmark of that something was off for my body.
Right. So maybe kind of in wrapping up, you could share how people can get in touch. You know, you've got your website, Facebook, and I think Instagram as well, and what working with you looks like, and any other closing thoughts you have on the topic.
Well, when someone asks to see me, I send them some forms to fill in just to give a basic overview of diet and health history. Initial consult is about 90 minutes, and I come back a few days later and give them a treatment plan. Treatment plan focuses on diet, lifestyle, and any supplements or herbs I think that they might benefit from. And I work with them over, well, many months usually, because with chronic disease, I'm working on underlying reasons for the chronic disease, the health condition they have a diagnosis of, that they might they want a different way of supporting that. And it seems to be, if the older someone is, the longer it tends to take for them to be satisfied with where they are. I like to see my clients like every month or 6 weeks following the previous appointment, and they get better results if they work with me like that. I think with MS it's when someone's diagnosed, it's so easy to like feed into the fear and look at horror stories online. Actually, my specialist said not to look at those things, and she was absolutely right. She said not to make big changes, not to do anything rash, because she'd seen it before, that it was a negative thing to go and do those things. And I'd agree, horror stories are helpful for no one. They just create more fear. I think being positive and being open-minded, if you choose to take the drugs, look into them really carefully before you do. Like, for some people, one drug may be contraindicated, like it was for me, or working with your specialist, you might find that a different one is a better fit for you. And some people actually get quite sick from them too, I've been told. I haven't tried them personally, so I can't say from my personal experience. If you choose to work with a natural practitioner, do your homework, because actually very few in New Zealand work with autoimmune or work with MS. Very few work with MS in New Zealand. And you need to find someone that resonates with you. And I think also just try and find the joy in life. What do you love doing? And find out what you can do each day to give you joy.
Yeah, no, that's all great. And like, it was hard to find others, you know, other possible options for like a presentation on MS within New Zealand. A podcast on MS, so it was fortuitous that, you know, I've met you before from somewhere else, so I was able to get this organized. And on your website, I think it says you also work with people remotely. So do you treat people? Are you allowed to treat people from overseas? Or sorry, not treat, you know, but consult them.
I am able to do that. I have currently only worked with people in New Zealand. I don't only work with MS. I see a lot of other health conditions where people want support. Typically women. I see a lot of hormone balance. Like, a lot of women need support with their hormones, and I work with that a lot, and gut health and various other things. But I do work online, and currently under level 4, I'm working online. Like, if I'm selling supplements, it's contactless, and obviously contactless consults right now.
Awesome. Well, it's been great having you on, Rachel. Thanks so much. And yeah, if people want to check your website, it is Rachel Stott Naturopath, and I'll put a link to that and whatever else you want in the description for this podcast, and other things that we mentioned, like the vitamin D lamp, or anything else that I think listeners might be interested in. So, yep, look forward to chatting again sometime soon.
Thank you. It was lovely to talk.
Awesome. Catch you later, Rachel.
Okay. Bye.